those two issues. I guess for those of us in audiences like this who would like to push those issues along as best we can, what do you think that at a government level or a community level we could be doing to promote each of those objectives?
Australia hasn't been too bad, actually, in recent times in terms of its re-engagement on multilateral issues and its role as a sort of a constructive player. John Douth, the Australian ambassador, my former chief of staff, actually, has been a terrific ambassador on the ground in New York and has re-established a lot of the credibility that we lost as a country, I think, over most of the last decade. And in terms of the Millennium Development Goals, I mean, the Howard government's commitment to do something about substantially increasing the ODA GNP ratio up to something, you know, sort of halfway credible and halfway respectable is an important step forward. And the way in which they're sort of recrafting a lot of their thinking about aid delivery. I mean, aid agencies around the world are basically divided into the dinosaurs and the SWIFT, and the Australian aid agency, and I was talking to them up in Canberra today, is really not bad. So there's a little bit of a shortfall in terms of a serious commitment to reaching 0.7 and hanging onto a timetable for doing that. And I think that's the pressure point that should be most exposed. Because after all, I mean, 0.7 of GDP, GNP devoted to development assistance is not something that is an impossible target to reach. It's reachable by any country because it's a relative target. It's not an absolute one in dollar terms, and it ought to be achievable for a rich country of the kind that we are. So I'd hang in there tough on that one. On the disarmament non-proliferation side, Australia's a kind of rather feeble echo of the United States' position on these things. It likes the idea of a comprehensive test ban treaty, but doesn't really want to say so, you know, too loudly. Likes the idea of fissile material cutoff treaty, which the US hates, but really doesn't want to say so too loudly. Emphasises all the supply side constraints, you know, more and more regimes designed to put regulatory constraints on the availability of nuclear stuff, fissile material technology and so on, but much less willing to acknowledge the need also to focus on the demand side to address countries, you know, genuine or perceived security concerns. And in particular, which is a constant recurring refrain in arms control and disarmament issues, to address the perceived hypocrisy and double standards of a nuclear regime which continues to preserve a completely, you know, distinguished and a preferred position for the nuclear haves and not the nuclear have-nots. And the only way you can square that particular circle is by the nuclear weapons haves committing themselves at least to ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons. But that's not something that's part of the Australians' repertoire. We led the world, in a sense, with the Canberra Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons, which was formed in the last days of the Keating government, and which came out with a report which had a real resonance around the world, making the case for the elimination of nuclear weapons on the simple mantra that if any country has them, any country retains them, other countries will want them, and so long as any country has nuclear weapons, they're bound one day to be used, either by accident or by design, and that's catastrophic. Very simple message, but very articulately expressed. The current government ran away from having anything to do with that. The baton was picked up by Canada and a whole bunch of other countries. And so, you know, the record has really been pretty flaccid on the subject of arms control and disarmament. I'm on a commission at the moment with Hans Blix chairing it to address all these issues over again. We thought, actually, when we started this enterprise last year, that the commission would be a bit redundant with the summit coming up with all sorts of, you know, terrific whiz-bang new principles and commitments, but the summit having come up with a complete blank of paper, I think there's a real job in agenda writing to be done. And if the Labor Party, Labor movement, is going to be sort of looking for some guidance as to basic core principles and priorities to pursue when it comes to WMD, I think the Blix Commission report, which is due out early next year, will be a pretty good blueprint to hang your hat on. So, you know, that's something to bear in mind in terms of the policy planning, if we do any policy planning anymore.
You mentioned how cheating did lead your way some years back. Is there any possibility that our present opposition to your state Labour Party
it doesn't make it any easier to answer. I think the basically, he wants me to plunge into a full-scale boots and all assault on the race to the bottom that's gone on this week and a few other things. But I wouldn't want to comment on that. So I really don't want to plunge into domestic political issues. I want to adopt the high ground, not least because, the outfit I'm running now, the International Crisis Group, really is, sort of totally non-partisan or meant to be, and we do have to develop, decent lines and relationships with people. So I just don't want to get into domestic politics as such. But I'm tempted, but no thanks.
I hope the gallery won't feel excluded. Yes, please.
Gareth, can you say something that's very topical on the whole area, on the whole area of terrorism, and how the UN as a world body can fight terrorism? Because it seems to me that we've had rather a knee-jerk reaction, and we really haven't got to the core of the problem of eliminating terrorism.
Well, it's a hell of a task to do because it's constantly mutating, the phenomenon, and the nature of the appropriate response to it gets harder and harder to properly define. But my take on all of this, which I've been talking about up and down the country in the last couple of days, is really that any kind of sensible, coherent policy response to terrorism has to be multi-dimensional. It can't just be focused on the homeland defence protection stuff and the policing side of the house, law enforcement, intelligence, and ultimately military. You can't not do that stuff, but that's not the end of the story. What you have to do is to have a political strategy which does address those genuine political grievances that exist out there and resonate in particular throughout the Arab Islamic world, talking obviously about Israel, Palestine, and Iraq, and half a dozen others of that kind. Not because that's necessarily the prime motivator for some of the extreme crazies who are doing these things, but because it's very much part of the environment in which they can better flourish if there is community support and a government unwillingness to be tough-minded about them, cracking down on terrorism in a lot of these countries because of a perception that, the means might be horrible, but the cause is just. So political grievance remedying is a very important part of that, as is another set of strategies which involve really very similar strategies to what we talk about as peace building. I mean, economic support for countries, governance, capacity building support, and the avoidance of the creation or maintenance of failed or fragile states, which are serious harbourers of terrorists, as we've come to appreciate. But the final element of it is the psychological strategy. And that's got two dimensions. One, at the sort of local level, trying to find authority figures that can articulate principles, again, particularly in Islamic communities around the world, that whatever else might be just about a cause, killing people in pursuit of it is not and certainly not sanctioned by the Quran. So winning that particular battle. Not easy to do it simply by interfaith dialogues. Terrorists tend not to read the products of interfaith dialogues. It's not even easy to do it by having a bunch of moderate clerics and scholars issuing moderate fatwas. What you really need is their role models, people that are significant players in the Salafi jihadist sort of terrorist universe to articulate the stuff. But that's important, that side of it. And the last part of the psychological story comes back very directly to your question. There does have to be some absolutely clear values and norms set and laid down and articulated by the broader international community. And that's where this business of a definition of terrorism comes in. We've got some